Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is April 21st, 2018, and this is episode 130 of Radio Warner. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Telescope Audio Studios here in Greenpoint. And I'm here in the studio with the Warner himself, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan. John, how you doing?
I'm good.
Okay. And John, why don't, let's introduce our guest. Do you want to introduce her? You're sitting next to her. We're very honored to have with us, John.
Yeah, Mei Zhang, one of the best investigative journalists working on Afghanistan. And we're going to be talking to Mei about her experiences in Afghanistan, the situation there, the problems of reporting there. It's a great opportunity for us because, as I was just saying to Mei, there aren't that many really good journalists working in Afghanistan, and we might as well get right to it.
Yeah. So really quickly, Mei, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Real quick announcement, and then we're going to get to this. There are now two events here in New York set up for John's book, The War Nerd Iliad, the great war novel, or war novel of our times. And so I just want to make this announcement now, and we'll talk about this again later. So Tuesday, May 2nd at NYU at 4 p.m., and we'll post this, I think, on the site and on the Gary Brecher Facebook page. So at NYU, there's going to be an event co-hosted by the Liberal Studies and Classics Department. So check in with us. And also Wednesday, May 23rd at the Red Room at the KGB Bar in Manhattan. So that's May 23rd. There'll be another Warnerd Iliad event there. So please come to that.
Red Room at the KGB is like blood overkill already. And then I'm going to read some from the Iliad and there, you won't be able to wade through that room.
So Mei, thanks for joining us. Mei, by the way, is a visiting scholar at the NYU Journalism School, and she's a freelance magazine writer. She's written articles for Politico, The Intercept, and one of the ones I think we want to get to right away is this great deep dive that was published late last year in These Times magazine, a deep dive into the dark side of the American counterinsurgency program, particularly in, am I pronouncing this right? Uruzgan?
That's right.
Yeah. Province, which is kind of smack dab in the center of Afghanistan, south of Kabul, southwest, I guess, a little bit of Kabul. I don't know. I think this is where I like to start with this story. This is really the story of a massacre, and it's probably one of these stories where it's one of the few massacres that will even make it to the reading public, because some of the people who were massacred happen to have important, powerful relatives, which suggests there's so much more dark stuff going on. But I think, first of all, Mei, could you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened, like kind of set up this story here?
Sure. I mean, exactly as you said, the only reason why we are sitting here talking about this story is because one of the victims had a powerful family member in a senator named Hanif Hanifi, who hailed from this village called Khas Uruzgan, which is already a 12-hour drive east of Tirinkot, which is the provincial capital of Uruzgan province, which is already, hours-long flight away from Kabul. And so it is a quite remote place. And there was, as you mentioned, there was a mass shooting of a bunch of farmers who were working in the field. And they were shot at by what is called the Afghan local police, which people often refer to as, you know, they're neither local nor are they police. They're armed gunmen. The idea was, it was born out of this need to recruit armed men who would fight against the insurgency, mainly the Taliban at the time. And now, of course, it includes other splinter groups as well, including, you know, Islamic State is the most famous. Mm-hmm. But back then, in the early days of the war, there was a great need to increase the Afghan security force. And what better way of doing that than arming local villagers? And so it's a community policing model that the Americans brought to Afghanistan and implemented to the great chagrin of these local villagers, who were often put in a situation where they were being regulated by officers who weren't from the region. And so what happened in this tiny village named Hasuduzgan is that there was a Hazara commander who had come to prominence because he had worked very closely with the special forces in the who had come to set up shop there. And the reason why he was a desirable ally to work together with for Americans was because the fact of him being Hazara, previously persecuted minority who had been they were at war with the Pashtuns, many of whom are members of the Taliban. This is a distinction that is important to make. Many Taliban happen to be of the Pashtun ethnicity, though not all. In the north, the dynamic is entirely different. But there's a conflating that happens where people then often associate people think the opposite is also true. They think, well, you know, obviously that means like all Pashtuns are members of the Taliban. Right. And this conflating has led to egregious civil rights violations in the post 9/11 era, especially in Afghanistan. And so anyways, back to this massacre, what happened was that...
And the Hazara, they're Shia, so they're...
Correct.
Right, so they're separate from, I guess, most people in Afghanistan. Certainly the Pashtun are Sunni, right?
Sure, so, and they're considered to be, you know, outside, heretical, you know,
right.
by certain sort
especially
of doctrinaire.
Especially from Diobani or something.
Exactly, right. Exactly, which is the spiritual root of the Mullah Omar, the founder of the Taliban. So the farmers are out in the field. It's unclear what farm they were doing, but they were tilling the land or some such. And then they hear that there's the ALP, the Afghan local police, are in the area, and they're trying to clear the area because a police checkpoint the night prior had been attacked, and so now they're out in the field looking for this sort of alleged Taliban surgeon who had attacked their police checkpoint. And so they hear that this is happening, and they kind of convene briefly, you know, should we flee? And by then they'd known to run away when the ALP were in power, when the ALP were present, because no good would come of their presence. But then they decided, actually, you know what though, you know, we belong to the Hanifi family, and he is an elected official, he has powerful friends, there's no way that something bad is going to happen to us. So then they continue to continue with their, you know, farming work, and while they're still working, they are shot up by these local police who report to a Hazara commander named Shujai, Abdul Hakim Shujai. And the rest of the story sort of talks about the patronage network that the Americans readily created that then ended up pitting previously persecuted minorities against currently persecuted majorities, rather. It's a story about counterinsurgency gone awry, and it's also a story about how many things can be true at the same time.
Right.
It fits with so many stories. This is one reason we wanted to talk to you about this, because you do a really good job of describing this incredibly messed up situation, because there's a tradition in occupations and counterinsurgencies of taking a group that has been persecuted in the past and using it against the formerly dominant group, making an alliance between the current occupier and the formerly persecuted group. And Hazara have definitely been persecuted in the past in Afghanistan. So it's a classic situation in that way.
That's right. And by, you know, coming in and siding with Hazaras, effectively what we've done is taking one side of an ongoing civil war. And I think that fact is lost on most Americans.
Mm. And also making sure that whenever we leave, and there will come a day when we leave, that the Hazara have made are going to suffer more again after that. I mean,
of course.
Know? Yeah. But this is, yeah, this is, John was saying, this is kind of a classic colonial strategy and counterinsurgency strategy, but and also it's kind of a classic American, not just American, British and French and others, but American counterinsurgency strategy is creating these kind of irregular death squads, basically death squads using some, because it's not like this Hazara ALP leader represents Hazara people, although he will, I'm sure, in the eyes of the Pashtun at some point. But he's a particular kind of Hazara. He's kind of a vicious psycho. I'm going to just read a little bit here where you describe it. Many, including, how do you pronounce the name? Shujavi?
Shujai, yeah.
Shujai, right. Shujai, this is the Hazara commander of this local ALP unit, which is basically goes from being an irregular to a regular, you know, and that's also pretty standard in a lot of counterinsurgency strategies from the Philippines and counterinsurgency in the 50s on. Yet many, including Shujai, were handpicked by U.S. advisors. Wali was present, so this is one of the local district police chiefs, was present during the meeting when U.S. captains pushed for Shujai to join the local ALP, that's the Afghanistan local police, despite villager protests that he was neither law-abiding nor from the area. Rumors about Shujai abounded. He had ordered 14 men to climb into a well and then stone them to death. His troops had burned a young girl alive and beaten a child to death in front of his mother. And the Americans were told about this, and what keeps happening in the story is he's protected by the Americans, and papers go missing, and he goes missing at key times, and he's clearly protected because this is a strategy to use somebody who can, I mean, you know, the counterinsurgencies oftentimes take on this logic. You need psychos to pacify the people you're trying to pacify, but they wind up kind of maybe terrorizing briefly or for some period the locals, but a lot of times that terrorizing winds up backfiring and creating a much worse problem, even from the counterinsurgency's point of view. Can you describe, you actually went out there to Uruzgan. In fact, in your article, you say you may have been the last Western journalist to have gone out there, because is it just too dangerous right now? Is that the case?
I mean, logistically, it's kind of impossible. I think commercial flights to Turinco doesn't happen anymore.
Mm.
And I think I was one of the last to catch the commercial flights. And now, I mean, the UN operates planes, but they're famously unreliable. They operate, you know, a flight a week. And if it gets canceled for various reasons, then you might be stuck out there for weeks, which is not a situation you want to be in.
What about road travel? Is that too dangerous?
Yeah, it's quite untenable because, I mean, the way that the security situation is such that there are all these like archipelagos of safety, like Kabul is safe, I don't know, Herat might be safe, Jalalabad City might be safe, Tirankot is also safe, but getting to and from is an impossibility. And so that's why you hear all these stories about district governors being flown in for 24 hours to adjudicate and, you know, do work and then being flown out. That was kind of one of the main sort of unofficial duties that the American military performed. And apparently, I've also heard stories about special forces flying out to, you know, whatever, drop down like food and supplies and ammunition or whatever, and having to fight off Afghan policemen and army soldiers who are trying to, you know, clobber their way onto the helicopters because they don't want to be where they are.
Wow.
And yeah, that's the security situation that we've created.
I want to actually get back to this story in a bit. I want to pull the camera back here just a little bit on the Afghanistan war. I want to talk first just a little bit about what the U.S. and the West are supposedly doing there, and then also about your own personal experience, and then we'll get back to this. But so I guess the first question is, you know, if somebody were just completely from the outside, said, "Well, actually, what are we doing there? What are we fighting for there? Why are we still there?"
Literally, no idea.
a guy I know who was in the Marines. I asked him some other kind of typical clusterfuck thing happened, and I. And then the Trump commander was saying, no, we can still win this, and, you know, did another search. And I was like, what's going on here? What's the point? And he said, well, basically nobody wants to be the one who is known for withdrawing the last troops from there. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. Maybe that's one purpose of the war. No one wants to be the one. You don't win awards for being the last one to withdraw, especially in the era of Trump, you know, and calling people losers. Mm. So there is a stated purpose, though, right? I mean, or no?
Honestly, if you know, please let me know, because it's totally unclear to me. I mean, I want to be clear that what we are experiencing now is an extension of what's come before. So there's nothing exceptionally egregious about what Trump is doing, one could argue. But at the same time, I do think that we're going through an exceptionally schizophrenic period of American foreign policy in Afghanistan. I mean, he's made comments about how he's never going to negotiate with the Taliban, while at the same time, Jim Mattis is out saying, you know, Taliban has expressed interest, while at the same time, America's main ally in the country, the Afghan government, has extended an olive branch, saying that they're willing to acknowledge the Taliban as a political party, which is a massive step towards some kind of peace.
Mm-hmm. And, well, this is something we see a lot recently, that I think, like a lot of Americans, I like to have the idea that compared to other more obviously fragmented governments, ours is generally pretty unitary and speaks with a single voice. But if that were ever true, and maybe it never was, it's not true now. We've seen with Syria, for example, the open disagreement between Pentagon and the CIA, high levels of the Pentagon and the officers actually tasked to training different groups. Mm-hmm. Any presumption that the American government is united seems to be out of date.
Sure. But I also don't want to be sitting here sort of opining the good old Obama days, because he's also responsible for increased drone strikes. He sent 100,000 troops during the surge, which accomplished nothing. Yeah. Everybody has blood on their hands.
Yeah. Going back to Bush in the beginning. I mean, in one of your articles, you talked about how at the very beginning of the war, so, you know, this may have been December of 2001, the U.S. and its allies and the Northern Alliance, they kind of pushed out the Taliban pretty quickly, and the Taliban seemed very ready to do a deal. And Karzai met them. You described the scene. Karzai met their representatives in the South, and they all did a peace deal, but that didn't go over with Rumsfeld, or he just ignored the message and chased them down and hunted them down and kind of forced the Taliban. I mean, there was no way of doing a peace deal, right? And that, do you think that was a missed opportunity, or were things going to go bad no matter what?
Oh, of course that was a missed opportunity. I mean, we should have put Osama bin Laden on trial. That was a missed opportunity. I mean, there was so many missed opportunities. The particular quote that I found to be really affecting, as told by Karzai, was that this Taliban commander had told him, it was something like, "And then when I saw my two daughters, you know, being chased into the mountains, I knew I had to fight forever." I mean, we really gave them, the movement, the Taliban, if it was an incipient, amorphous thing that existed, I mean, we really gave them a mission and shape that we're trying to deal with now. And there's a really great book called An Enemy We Created by these two leading Taliban scholars. And that book really goes into how, yeah, everything is our own making. We are responsible for our own misfortune in many ways.
You don't have their names.
I do. That? I do.
Okay. The Enemy We Created is the name of the book, just for our listeners.
It's terrific. I mean, most serious Afghanistan scholars have read it. It's by Felix Kun, and the second author, his name is Alex von Strick something something. Super long last name. He's a very good friend, but I don't know how to pronounce his name.
We won't tell him.
Okay.
Before this book, I guess, well, I mean, I remember the first time I read about the Taliban, it was the Pakistani writer, was it Ahmed Rashid? Was
That's
that his
right.
name? Yeah, that was quite a good book, but I don't know how well it's held up, or I guess things have just changed so much since then, right?
Yeah, I guess back then there was nothing. People weren't, Afghanistan wasn't sexy and cool and
right.
No one really cared and they didn't know where it was on the map. There were maybe five people who had studied it.
Right.
Maybe we should talk to you about the books that people get about Afghanistan, because you mentioned Anand Gopal, No Good Men Among the Living. Is that a book you would recommend?
Yeah, I think that's the best book that's been written on Afghanistan.
Yeah. And there are some other really interesting cases. There's a very popular book and I think movie now that gets at claims to get at the Hazara Pashtun ethnic divide called The Kite Runner, right?
By
Khaled Husseini. What do you think of that book?
I think any works of literature or film or short story that engages American readers about what's happening outside of their own sphere is a worthy endeavor.
Right.
And I read The Kite Runner, and then that made me curious about certain things, which then led me to, you know, reading other books that were a bit more nuanced.
Right.
John, I mean, you can be honest, John. You were not so crazy about that book.
Well,
it's a setup.
No.
I was trying to be diplomatic.
I know. I could tell. That's why I said it, because I was like, okay, if you loved it, I wouldn't have said anything. But you were being diplomatic. I mean, so John, what did you think?
It's a little overdone in some ways. The plot of The Kite Runner is an allegory about the persecution of the Hazara and the evils inflicted, and there have been evils, there's no doubt about that, inflicted on them. But the plot is basically there's a Pashtun narrator who's of a very good influential family, and his family are good cosmopolitan people. His best friend is a Hazara. He ends up abandoning his Hazara best friend at a crucial moment when the friend is being cornered and raped by an older kid who turns out to have a weird resemblance to Mullah Omar, especially in the sense that he's always about to lose an eye. during the rape scene, he threatens this older kid with shooting his eye out, and eventually, after he rapes this Hazara, and then he rapes that Hazara man's son many years later, and then the son puts his eye out with a slingshot or something. And the Mullah Omar character is half German, half Pashtun, and
so he's really evil.
But it's not the Germans are evil, because his mother is German and she's very kind and she tells him Hitler is bad, but he knows better, and Hitler is actually good as far as he knows. And he becomes the specialist in stoning people to death in the stadium in Kabul or Kandahar, I forget which. So it's very allegorical. It's somewhat overdone. But
it's probably the most famous, of novels about Afghanistan.
Yeah, and as May said very diplomatically, did get people out. I mean, it's not an L.A. two-character drama, okay?
Right.
So it gets people out of that range,
right.
and that's
right.
good. But there are some other interesting books while we're on the subject. Like Kim Barker, Taliban Shuffle, Did you by any chance know Kim Barker?
I do know Kim, and the film is often brought up as, oh, you live in Afghanistan. Is it like this? And I regret to inform you that in parts it is very true to life.
Yeah. It seemed like a good book to me. The book is called The Taliban Shuffle. The movie, I think, was called Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie. But I think Mark and I both read the book and both really enjoyed it. Yeah. And I enjoyed it because an American expat who spent a lot of time, not necessarily by choice, but just to make a living, bouncing around some weird parts of the world. And it's a good description, among other things, of the bizarre bipolar mood swings you have as an expat, from thinking, I love this place, I was always meant to be here, and, oh, God, I hate this. This place is driving me crazy. You go through that about 12 times a day in really difficult parts of the world. And Kim Barker does a really good job of describing that honestly.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's useful to not take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she describes a period that was a bit before you went there, right? I mean, you first arrived in Kabul, and when was it exactly again?
So I flew into Kabul first week, January 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And when I showed up, people said, you got here too late. The party's over. When I see people moving to Kabul now, I say the same thing, and I really believe it.
That's a big expat.
That is a very big one. Yeah. I know that very
well.
You
should have come here during the first album before it sold out.
Exactly.
So I think she was there more in the later, the second part of the Bush years, if I remember right.
I don't remember the timeline, really. But yeah.
When you were there is when the Obama surge is starting to, he's starting to wind it down. Is that right?
Yeah, and there was always a sort of end of world feeling. They all talked about the withdrawal, capital W, withdrawal,
right,
that would happen at the end of 2014. And there was always this feeling of, it was as if January 1st, 2015 would not occur in Afghanistan. There was a real sense of this sort of firm deadline, and then our engagement would be over. And I find that to be really striking. And then much of my reporting has been around this theme of the fact that the war isn't over, and it's just being fought off the public record now.
Right. Well, and so many things are off the public record, such as even this Afghan local police force, they literally don't have records on some of the things that they're doing there, right?
Exactly.
Makes reporting there pretty tough. John, you want to, let's continue with the book's theme, and then we'll go to another theme in a second. I mean, while we're on this theme, one thing I wanted to recommend, I told John before the show, so I went and saw Flight. Have you heard of this?
No.
Okay, so it's, it's really cool. It's really unexpected. So my wife told me about this. It's at the the McKittrick Hotel in, I think it's in the Soho area, where they have this something called Sleep No More. Anyway, it's a 45-minute spectacle. I don't know what you call it, where it's all little toy models that tell the story of these two brothers, Afghan brothers, who leave Afghanistan in the war and try to go. Their dream is to go to England, and one of them wants to be learn about software and be a coder there, and the other one, they want to get away from the war and go there and start new lives, and their parents send them there. So they go through this horrific, it's like the anti-Homer experience, and very grim and very moving as hell experience. And it's all done in toy models. So you're sat in your own private booth, and there's this giant sort of wheel that moves slowly around. So you're sitting there in your own booth, and everybody's around this wheel, and there's a soundtrack in your headphones, so everybody's individualized, and the wheel moves around, so you see different scenes of these little models of these two brothers going through all these horrific experiences and some really great experiences, most of them are pretty horrific, as they travel as refugees, which we read about a lot. But and what was so surprising to me, and then you hear the story narrated, you hear their voices, you know, it's actually just the characters' voices talking. And like when they get to France, the French border guards are represented as raptor seagulls, but in French border guard suits, and they're truly terrifying. And they pack them all into Calais, and it's a very, very emotional experience. And you wouldn't think little toy models, on these sort of giant wheels moving around, they get lit up and then fade out, and the next one lit up, and you just see these scenes that it kind of just reminds you of all the different ways your brain can be tricked into being sucked into what feels like somebody's life and world, you know, and especially something this remote. So I really would recommend it. It's pretty good. So, but here, it's based on a novel that came out in 2012 called Hinterland by Caroline Brothers. And then it was turned into a play by a British playwright called Oliver Emmanuel. And then now it's this, somebody turned it into this like toy models play. And at an Edinburgh festival, and then that got brought out over here. So I would recommend it, though. It's pretty intense, really good. But May, would you have any other books that you would recommend, or novels or anything? Are there any Afghan writers as well that you would recommend? Are there many?
Not that many.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you bring up like a point, or a point that you've alluded to, which is that sometimes I found that journalism is almost not an adequate medium to convey to readers or viewers what it's really like, because as we discussed, so much of it is not verifiable. But, you know, for example, conspiracy theories I find so fascinating because they're not true, most of them, but they reveal a kind of a psychological truth about the place and the people.
Mm-hmm.
But those things I can't print, obviously. And I've always thought that was a shame. If there were more graceful ways of trying to convey the complicated nuances of a place. There's so many books, scores and scores of books. I really would recommend Anand's and An Enemy We Created.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good companion, and I've now remembered how to pronounce my friend's name, which is Alex van Linschoten.
Mm-hmm.
And I would actually also recommend an Adam Curtis documentary.
Oh,
Adam
Curtis, Bitter Lakes.
Great, exactly.
Yeah.
He had access to the BBC archives, combed through all of it, and made, you know, in classic Adam Curtis style, this incredible documentary that is really weirdly moving and full of drama, despite the fact that it's all archival footage. And there's a...
I actually helped him a little bit with some of that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
wow.
He asked me for some help with some...
That's terrific.
With some of the Russian, because he also got some Russian invasion occupation era stuff.
Of course.
He's great.
I believe you. And there was a couple, I think the first winter I came back to New York, I guess, I think many people go through withdrawal phases or they're trying to readjust. And I basically just spent all of that time watching every single War on Terror movie. And they're all pretty bad. But
like which ones? I want to
literally
hear this.
Like I think there were
what ones stick out in your
I
head?
I can't even just all the ones like all the big
the one that I remember from Afghanistan is Restrepo.
That one's quite good actually.
That was good,
there's another one called A Thousand Times Goodnight or something about a photojournalist. There's so many journalist movies about war zones. But there's one called In the Valley of Ella by Catherine Bigelow that I actually think is quite good.
In the Valley of
Ella, I think.
Ella, okay.
It has a big reveal at the end, but the thing that I really appreciate it was that it's just very unclear what happens throughout the whole film. And I think I felt like that was a meta commentary on the war itself. When you're in it, you have no idea what's going on most of the time. And I felt like that was interesting.
Well, that links up to what you said about conspiracy theories, because that's, I think, generally in war zones, nobody quite knows what's true, and everyone has the sense that they're being lied to by the people who control the official channels of communication. So people try to make up for this, and they make up their own stories. So this is a really interesting feature, especially of irregular wars like this. So what are some powerful conspiracy theories operating in Afghanistan?
That the Taliban's funded by the CIA.
Is that a conspiracy theory?
That's the thing. But then you realize that, okay, so why do people think this? For many reasons, but it's not entirely insane because the contractors that the American military hired, often to secure passage rights on roads, would pay off local insurgents, which were part of the Taliban insurgency. And so for a villager observing this back and forth, it's not entirely insane for them to draw the conclusion, like cut out the middleman.
Right.
It looks like they're business partners.
Absolutely, sure. And the people that the American military allied with, so back to Uruzgan, the famous police commander there was often in close dealings with his equivalent, basically, in the insurgency. And so for a lot of people, the optics were such that it really isn't totally insane for these people to be drawing certain conclusions.
There's truth to it. Yeah, I mean, that sort of collusion, I remember certainly in the first Chechen War, I mean, there was a lot of that kind of business collusion between Chechen rebel commanders and various Russian commanders. And so the general, you know, the taxi driver, whatever, you know, the general conspiracy theory in the street is, well, they're all doing this just because it's good business. And in fact, Boris Berezovsky reportedly said, actually General Lebed quoted him on this, that Berezovsky said when Lebed cut the peace deal, he said, Sasha, Alexander, short for Alexander Sasha, he said, that's something like, Sasha, you just ended a really great business for me there. it's not true to say that war was just purely done in order to, and continue just to do business between the two, but there was certainly elements of truth to that. There was so much kind of corrupt dealing and, it was good business for some people there.
Did you find it easy to get Afghans to talk about these things? I mean, how well did you have to know someone before they told you the CIA is funding the Taliban, or will they just tell you that right out?
No, I mean, this is the note that we would end most interviews on, as you know. Now tell me, emissary from the West, is this true?
Yeah.
Well, also, the CIA did help start and create and fund the Mujahideen, so you can see why they said that. And then, of course, also our allies, the Saudi, the Gulf states, and the Pakistanis are. And I assume they're still funding the Taliban. Is that right? I mean, it's become a lot messier recently, it seems like who's on whose side, because you also have a very violent and apparently quite well-funded Islamic State faction in Afghanistan. I'm not sure how well they're doing exactly right now, but for a while they were making a lot of noise and killing a lot of Hazara, by the way, among others. And, who's on whose side now? I mean, and you're hearing from the military now since Trump came to power that Russia and Iran, I mean, this is in the New York Times too, are apparently backing and maybe even arming the Taliban to try to gain influence with them. Like, who's on whose side anymore? Do you know?
I mean, that sounds really nefarious when it's phrased like that, but I think it's perfectly normal for regional powers to be vying for positions in a country like Afghanistan. And so, yeah, of course, all the usual suspects are involved in various ways. ISIS, I mean, the more cynical of the Afghan watchers will say that ISIS is the best thing that's happened to Afghanistan. It was able to renew interest in a country that was slipping off the map in many ways. And they are, I don't think they're in the wane in any way. Among the so-called spectacular attacks that's happened in Kabul just in the early months of this year alone, about half of them are attributed to ISIS.
Okay.
And these spectacular attacks, I remember when I was younger, when I moved there, they would kill scores, and now it's quite common for these attacks to kill people,
Okay.
In you know, over 100 civilians on average.
Yes, there was a particularly lethal attack in Kabul with something like 300 killed, if I remember correctly.
It was that's interesting you say that, because the official count is over 100, 103, I think, but then local media reports quoted 300.
Right.
And this is again the impossibility of reporting on a country like this. You're meant to, journalistic standards require you to go by official records,
right.
And
right.
The government is just notoriously not reliable when it comes to death tolls. Mm-hmm. And so then you talk to people on the ground, you try to look for other indicators. Like I spent some time talking to coffin makers to try to figure out a way around that particular issue. But they're not verifiable. And so then all you're left with really is a range.
Mm-hmm. That's some grim work doing, going to talk to coffin makers, which brings me back. I want to get back to actually how you got involved in this story. I mean, did you study journalism before you went out to Kabul, or what got you involved in journalism? Were you doing any local journalism, or how did you get into it?
Well, I always knew I'd be a writer.
Mm.
And in college, I think I thought I was going to be a organizer.
Mm.
So I did organizing on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of got into journalism that way. I had a column in the college newspaper writing about climate change. That was my interest at the time. And then...
was this UBC in Vancouver?
No, I defected from the West Coast. And I went far away to the University of Toronto, Trinity College.
Right.
Which was an amazing learning environment. I highly, highly recommend anyone considering it. You can go to school for free practically.
Uh-huh.
And campus newspapers. And then I'd taken a bunch of courses on Middle Eastern studies. And I mean, it's just impossible to avoid being curious about Afghanistan, because I am a product of the post 9/11 world. I started reading newspapers really in earnest when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was the first time when, previous to 9/11, history was a thing that had already happened. And I felt like that was the first time when things were happening on my watch.
Right.
And so that got me keenly interested.
That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
That it was even the official view that history had stopped. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We were through with that. Now we had matured.
Yeah.
Now we're matured, and we're all just in the free marketplace.
Yeah. This turned out to be a bit of an oversimplification.
Exactly. I remember watched a clip recently where Bush says something like, you know, the time for grieving is over, time for action is now, and it's like September, like 20th or something.
Yeah. And go shopping, I think, is the thing you said. And yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, it was strange.
Well, I think it was possible for a lot of people to avoid Afghanistan because they were scared. I mean, was that a factor for you? Did you find Afghanistan frightening on a daily basis?
No. I mean, if you're
really
scared every day, you can't live.
Right.
I mean, it's one of those things, right, where from the outside, it looks like, well, there must be nothing but bombs and time. But when you're there, you feel a little bit more safe than you really are, but you feel like you get a feeling for the place and you know it. Is that how it was for you? And so you kind of feel like you know what's dangerous and what isn't.
I mean, in terms of going, I think people build things up in their heads and they don't realize that Kabul is a city too. People live there.
Yes.
Their families. They send their kids to school. They fight, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People fall in love and fall out of love. Like, all the normal things that happen anywhere in the world also happens in Afghanistan.
Right.
And that's a failure of our imagination.
Right.
It's true. When you live in places that have a scary rep, often, well, in my experience, often what happens is you realize, I'm going to get killed in this traffic. I don't know how they drive in Kabul, but... like in provincial Saudi Arabia, the driving is terrifying.
Sure. And I have thought that, you know, actually as I'm like being super irreverent, of course, when you're there, there is a sense of you're hyper aware of your surroundings. I get very anxious when I'm stuck in traffic, because then who knows what will happen. But I also, it just feels like you can die doing anything. There's a writer that I really admire named Catherine Boo who wrote this incredible book on India. Mm-hmm. And I was reading it right after college. It came out.
What's the name of the book?
Behind the Beautiful Forever. Uh-huh. It's really terrific. Okay. Peerless. Mm-hmm. And in the author's note, I remember, she talked about how, because she has this physical ailment, she wasn't sure if she could commit to spending 3 years living in a Bombay slum, writing about the people there. And then she said while she was still in this deliberation process, she got up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water from the kitchen and tripped over a thesaurus and broke a rib.
Okay.
And the lesson that she...
Sorry, I shouldn't... Tripping over a thesaurus is too much of an occupation.
The lesson for me there was that you can die doing anything.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Wow.
So you got there... In January 2013, and did you think you were going to be doing sort of war journalism there, or kind of, you know, I mean, what you do isn't quite war journalism. You go more, you take a story and then you sort of you bring the reader into kind of more deeper levels of what's really going on in the war. It's not strictly like this battle happened. Mm-hmm. You take kind of a thread of a story and you learn more about the broader picture. But I mean, did you have that idea when you were there in January 2013? You were going to be staying there for a while, and who did you, were you able to? I mean, who did you meet there? Where did you stay? How did you figure out where to stay? And initially, how to keep yourself safe and stuff.
I had no idea. I was 24.
Yeah.
What does anyone know when they're 24? I had no idea. But I had a vague sense, I guess, that I would write longer stories. Mm-hmm. And retroactively, I can now diagnose my interests as being interested in American power abroad. And I guess more a loftier version of that is I think I'm interested in hypocrisy, mm-hmm. and power, and there's a lot of that on display. I mean, if you really want to understand how power works, Afghanistan is among the best places to go to.
Because it's so raw and right there.
And, yeah. And it plays out in different ways, and I think it's something about seeing things at a certain remove allows you to see things more clearly. And in a weird way, I felt like I was able to understand the world that I came from, like, North America. I grew up in America, and then we moved to Canada. Like, this world more clearly, because our purported values and interests were being played out in a really sort of naked way in Afghanistan. And that really helped me understand America.
Mm. Well, and one particularly gruesome and infuriating, you know, way that story's played out is, well, you have this... It's bringing me to one of your, another really good piece you did here. It's called, it's in the London Review of Books, and the headline is Diary Femicide in Kandahar. And this is obviously a big issue. And anytime we talk about the war in Afghanistan is women and the quote unquote liberation of women there and the reality of what women's lives are like there and the women who we allegedly went there to liberate, what's happened with them. If you don't mind, John, I just want to read a little passage from this. It begins anyway. On the morning of 25th September 2006, Safiya, the first head of the Women's Affairs Department in Kandahar, was climbing into a rickshaw to go to work when two men on a motorcycle drove by and shot her three times. Safiya's death was the first, but soon I learned that there had been 12 other women who had been murdered there since the NATO invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. After Safiya, there was Hosai, a 19-year-old who worked for a private military contractor, who also died on her morning commute. In September 2008, Sitara, a provincial council member, and Malalai, a police officer, were both shot in front of their homes. Then Zargona, a doctor, was murdered. And in 2013, another Zargona, a police officer, was killed on duty. The murder rate accelerated in 2015. Rahila, another police officer, was gunned down on the job. Torpakai, a political affairs assistant for a local United Nations office, was assassinated while driving to work. Nargis, a health worker, was shot and killed while giving out vaccines. In March 2016, Fauzai, an administrative clerk for the provincial passport office, was shot in the head and died. In May, Nasreen, a police officer, was shot but survived. A week later, Layla, a 25-year-old student, was kidnapped while walking to school, supposedly because her sister, a well-known poet, was, quote, too loud, unquote. It was rumored that Layla had also been raped. Half of her body was found 15 days later. The other half had been eaten by dogs. Brutal stuff. And, you know, you talk about how we went in and I remember this from the beginning of the war, too. There was, I mean, the repression and oppression of women by the Taliban is undeniably brutal. But it, when you read your stories, it sounds like in many ways we've created conditions to make things a lot worse. First of all, we're a foreign power, and anybody who's should, if you followed any wars or if you think about your own community, should know that anytime a foreign power comes in, it's just never going to be popular. Or if it's popular, it's going to be popular for maybe a week, as long as it gets rid of your whoever's been oppressing you, and then you got to get out. And here we have a situation where, the way you describe it, where, you know, millions of Afghan women, girls, have gone through schools or programs funded by the West, and who now kind of have to hide, because, and many of whom are sort of branded by that. I don't know. First of all, I guess if you can just sort of talk about the general situation there, and what it was like reporting on that as well.
Sure. Well, when you say that the Taliban's, people often talk about Taliban attitude and treatment towards women. Our so-called allies were, you know, it was the same, if not worse. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the great tragedies of an already tragic situation, how women's rights was co-opted to provide a cause for war. And I don't think that the women's rights movement really properly recovered from that blow, because quickly after that happened, this association happened. Feminism and gender and women's rights became almost a shorthand for Western intervention or ideas that are foreign to, you know, Afghanistan. And so any old, you know, elected official who wanted to earn quick sort of brownie points for being patriotic or Afghan or Muslim or whatever would just throw the women's rights issue under the bus. And that's really all that he needed to do. And yeah, it's a real shame. And again, this idea, so there's that stuff happening. But, and then the practicalities of, okay, so we've propped up certain women leaders in communities, and now we're pulling out, what happens to them? And I mean, all of this is an intellectual exercise for us, but for these women, I mean, their lives are really on the line. There's a girls' school in Kandahar that I've gotten to know in my reporting, and I've grown quite close to the principal there and his whole family. And just sort of seeing how, seeing the, like, his fortune ebb and flow, the sort of, you know, flush of cash in the good years, and he really did good work. And it almost, you know, the local politicians would be jockeying for favor with him, because even though he was just a principal at a girls' school, during the years when funding was good, he held incredible power. And now he's in hiding because he can't be seen around town anymore, because he's associated with a certain brand of American largesse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this happens. I mean, sounds a lot like Vietnam, too, you know, and then eventually you leave, and the people who are associated with you and sort of believed in you or took your money or whatever, they're...
Well, one thing that you see often nostalgically depicted is the good old days in Afghanistan, and it's often related to the idea that women had it better before, well, some pick your date, you know, at some time in the past. And is that, you see old footage of Afghan women wearing Western dress, which is taken perhaps naively to be an evidence of social freedom. And the idea is that it's gone backwards. Is that an Afghan idea, or is that a do Afghan women feel that way, or do just Western observers feel that way?
Well, that's the thing, right? What do you mean by Afghan women? Mm. I mean, we can't talk about American women in any meaningful way, so we can't do that with Afghan women.
Right.
What's striking to me is that this miniskirt photo, it's almost as if like modernity is a kind of a virtue. It's like heralded.
Yeah.
And H.R. McMaster, the outgoing security advisor, is said to have brought up these photos to Trump to make a case for war yet again.
Wow.
And
making the world safe for miniskirts.
Sure, exactly. In a language that Trump can understand.
Yeah.
I think it's more that I think urban elites around the world have more things in common with each other
than,
you know, the rural counterparts.
Yeah.
And that's often forgotten. And so, yes, of course, I'm sure in the late 60s, early 70s, lives for select women coming from a particular class living in specific cities in Afghanistan with certain purchasing power and clout, yes, lives were better for them. But that's the other thing. It was less about them being able to wear miniskirts. It was more about the fact that it was peacetime.
Right.
I feel like that is often forgotten. There's so much money being spent on gender projects without realizing that the primary objective has to be ending the war first, because with an ongoing battle, like conflict in the backdrop, I mean, yes, like quality of life is never, ever going to get any better in a meaningful way.
Right.
Well, that brings me to two questions, but first is a journalism question. How hard was it to be able to talk to, and I'll, you know, put the air quotes around it, that, you know, Afghan women, but I mean, of course, women in different parts of the country that you went to, you know, Kabul versus where I imagine it would be easier versus when you went to Uruzgan or Kandahar or other regions. I mean, how accessible were women in terms of doing your stories?
I think there's often a misconception that female foreign correspondents get this like free pass into this, the other half. And that is not true, because you still have to build trust. Just because I am like, we are of the same sex, doesn't mean that. It's almost this weird like reverse misogyny that men think that like women just click and bond, and like, I don't know what they think we do when we're together. But I mean, you still need to be a professional, present your case for why they should talk to you.
Right.
And they need to trust you. And so I don't think it's any easier, I mean, necessarily that, I mean, it really, yeah, I don't think I can say that it's somehow dramatically easier because I'm a woman and they're a woman too, and we talk about our feelings and everything's great. I mean, I still need to go through various interlocutors, whether it be an interpreter, because I don't speak Pashto, and most of these stories take place in Pashtun communities, or just the sheer fact that like I'm not known to them. I'm a total stranger. Why would you tell anything to a total stranger? As you're going through media intermediaries, and these intermediaries tend to be men, and so, you know, getting to the wives and the daughters and the sisters still happen through the men. It's a man's world.
That's a really interesting question. The need to go through an interpreter.
Yes.
I mean, that you're forced to rely for any understandable version of what you're hearing from, a male stranger. Are there female interpreters in Afghanistan?
There are some, but I tried very, very hard just on principle to hire a female translator, and it was very difficult.
Because it's not considered an appropriate occupation, or they just haven't had the educational opportunities?
No. There are incredibly talented, able female interpreters, but the kind of work I do involves leaving on a moment's notice to a physically dangerous part of the country with other men. I mean, I am kind of considered a kind of a third sex, right? Like I'm this.
Yeah, we were talking about that before the show, that in many places. A foreign woman is not a woman in the same sense as a local woman.
Sure.
It's a given that you'll have license, although you can't always count on that. I was involved with someone who was part of the Human Terrain Program, and I remember a lot of their work involved sending Western anthropologists, often female anthropologists, to talk to village elders, and some of them died doing that because they were seen as, they overstepped that license,
mm-hmm.
and they were asking the wrong questions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I imagine that, yeah, you're seen as a distinct group or a distinct category. But you still have to find someone you can trust as an interpreter. I imagine that's a rough process.
It is, but a super necessary one.
Yeah.
And in a way, that process is quite organic. You just kind of work with a bunch of them, and then you bond with a few, and that's who you go with.
Right.
So that kind of leads to the other question as well, which is being a woman, foreign woman journalist, but I guess you kind of answered that out there. When you were there, were there many, like, what was the ratio, would you say, of women journalists to male journalists, and what was the scene kind of similar to what Kim Barker described still, the foreign community scene, or?
Yeah, of course. Uh-huh. I remember walking into rooms where I was like the only woman of reproductive age in a room of like hundreds and hundreds of men.
That's funny. I like the way you put that. I want to pull the camera back again a little bit here, because I know we've gone on a long time, but I just still had a couple of questions. At this point, I guess two questions. One is, do you think there was a strategy that could have ever worked? Or, could it have worked better, I guess? I know a friend of mine out in who was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal out in Russia, I knew he had gone in 2001. He was sort of one of those journalists who went in from the North with the Northern Alliance and really fell in love with the place and just always kind of kept retelling those stories. And he went back in, I think it was 2007, for the first time in several years, 2006 or 7. And he came back so angry and said, we completely blew it there. I mean, we had so much goodwill when I first arrived. And now I'm back here, and like, it's all the people I first made contacts with talk about is how we completely blew it, and this place is exploding, and and there's almost nothing really we can do about it at this point. He was really angry, but I was sort of wondering, what could we have done short of just pulling out, after pulling out, maybe backing Karzai in his original deal and just kind of pulling out. I just would imagine like most people in most countries, nobody likes to be occupied by foreigners. So I guess my question is, do you think there was a strategy that could have worked or worked better?
I just think that's a matter of how far back you're willing to go.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. Should we have invaded?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think I mentioned it briefly in the beginning. Maybe a better way of setting precedent would have been trying Osama bin Laden in court of law instead of this mad manhunt that we've been on. And then, let's say, okay, so then we've already invaded. What do we do? Yeah, we should have made peace with the Taliban right there and then when there was interest in doing so. But there was no political will because we were under the perception that we were winning. So when you're winning, why would you then, try to go back and share the spoils? There's so many junctures where things could have been different. But I think to say that had we tried a different policy, we would have succeeded already implies that we're going in with a certain agenda. And I just don't think that's how superpowers work.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're there to exert our own interest and safeguard them. And according to that very narrow definition, we're actually doing quite well, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah, that brings up something I think we've talked a lot about on this show, which is it helps if you kind of look at America as a foreign country. Mm-hmm. And then you look at it, okay, well, how is it acting? How is it behaving? Why is it behaving this way? And I mean, for example, promoting gender equality. This is something important to rally support for a continued occupation and war in Afghanistan. You know, you tell stories about the horrible things that happened to women there, and who but a jerk would say, you know, well, that we shouldn't try to liberate and protect these women. I mean, this is done. But then what we wind up doing, of course, is creating a whole giant new pool of potential future victims by meddling in their so deeply in their culture like that. You know, the Rumsfeld ignoring Karzai's peace deal very early on in December 2001. This is, again, if you look at America as a foreign country, and at least half, I think, of our subscribers are outside of America anyway. I mean, Rumsfeld is doing something that makes more sense when you look at America as a foreign country, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it doesn't care that much about actually a peace deal. What he's looking at is America was attacked. The politics, the domestic politics are such that, no, you need to tell everybody back at home that you're chasing them and killing them, these bad guys, and, you know, you're getting this war going on and mobilizing and organizing everybody behind your politics that way. So it's a lot of the strategies, I guess is what I'm saying, is to understand the war and why it's gone quote unquote badly is really about domestic politics in this country, in America. Obama's surge, Trump's surge, these have seemed to have less to do with sort of pure military or geostrategic questions than they do with domestic politics. Does that sound right?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Yeah.
One other interesting question when we're talking about how women's lives will evolve is what happens with technology and what happens with money, because those will often short circuit the most conservative patriarchal goals. I'm thinking of a provincial Saudi Arabia where officially gender segregation is a law, something that you should always work towards. But then there's cell phones and there are shopping malls. And if you combine cell phones and shopping malls, young people start working out other ways of mixing. Nobody can do anything about that. But for that, you sort of need money and you need peace. The more peace and money you have, the more possibilities there will evolve. I was wondering about that. In fact, how do cell phones work in rural Afghanistan? Do most people have cell phones?
Mm-hmm. That's the one thing that all sides agree on that they need. And so cell phone towers are rarely, if ever, attacked.
Wow. That's amazing. So they have an amnesty, do they?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The cell phone companies do quite well. It's one of the rare success stories. I don't know of anyone who does not have a cell phone at this point.
Yeah.
Huh. It's allowed for a bit more social interaction, much more social interaction, rather, than just 10, 15 years ago. Absolutely.
Yeah, because you can be in your room where you're supposed to be.
Exactly.
But you can still be in contact with people all over the world, and you can be watching those South Korean dramas that maybe where I was in Saudi Arabia, those things were incredibly powerful. They had a huge influence on young women. And my wife, who taught at the local college, said that students were learning Korean so that they could take a bigger part in watching these shows in the original. And that was giving them a very different idea of life. And that was a peacetime phenomenon. And as I think you were implying, when you're at war with an occupying foreign power, it tends to enforce a kind of social conservatism as a kind of patriotic requirement.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's often, it's a really great exercise. One of you mentioned this exercise of seeing America as if it were a foreign country. I mean, the way that foreign correspondents, myself included, have gone to these countries like Yemen, like Afghanistan, like Somalia, and have reported on these countries. If the same people came to America and tried doing that, I mean, we would call them charlatans, right? Mm. Why, you don't even speak the language. You have no idea what's going on. Like, how could you possibly write about a country in that way?
Yeah.
And exactly as you say, I think the insistence on social strictures happen in a community that feels like they're under siege.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you see this in America too right now. Mm-hmm.
Very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I think, John, we've kept you so long. It's been a really fantastic interview. So I know that your initial interest was literary. Actually, I think ours was too, and we wound up in journalism for various, for various reasons. But are you planning to stick with journalism, or are you interested in doing fiction as well?
Yeah, of course. I am one of those assholes who think fiction is the higher calling.
Yes.
And so probably. I mean, there's an Intercept piece that I did about a drone strike.
Uh-huh.
I'm working on a script that is inspired from that event.
Great.
Yeah, I'm interested in different ways of storytelling. It doesn't need to be journalism. I just think that that's what I enjoy now, mm-hmm. and I've gotten somewhat good at. And I think it's a very effective medium, especially magazine stories. People actually read them.
Right.
And people talk about them, and that way you can sort of contribute to the public conversation, which I think is something that's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there will be other ways. Maybe this thing you mentioned, I don't know what it's called.
Flight.
Yeah.
Flight.
I mean,
yeah.
If that engages people, I think that's terrific.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely recommend it. Okay, mate. Well, we kept you on so long. You've been very gracious with us and patient, and I appreciate it so much that you came here and spoke to us all this time. May
yes,
John.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks,
thank you. People often ask how they can help.
Mm.
And I would recommend, there is this girls' school I mentioned in Kandahar that is still receiving funding. And I've seen how they operate. Every single dollar goes towards paying for generators and paying for buses that help students get to school.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is this lesser known Italian NGO called Emergency. They run a hospital where they help save lives of war victims. And I've also seen them work up close. It's a really, really tight-knit operation. There's no gravy of any kind. And I think they do amazing, amazing work. And so those are the two things I would recommend.
Can you tell us once more the names of them?
Sure. Yeah. So the NGO is called, the hospital is called Emergency. It's an Italian-run NGO that runs surgical centers and war zones.
Uh-huh.
And the other one is called Kandahar Institute for Modern Studies, and it's an all-girls school that is run out of in Kandahar City.
Right.
And yeah, it's really great.
Great. All right. Thank you again, May.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break and come back after some more music by, since many people have asked, by our man, Brendan Enderegg. Thank you. Okay, so that was our interview with Mei Zhong. Excellent interview. And, you know, one thing that sort of sticks with me in this is she didn't seem to, she didn't seem as kind of concerned about the danger she might have been in as, but I think you kind of have to be that way if you're going to cover war zones. Like, I think it's better if it hits you 20 years later and you're like, but she really seemed, I don't think it was, it definitely wasn't like showing off or anything. I think she genuinely just didn't seem to have powerful memories of really fearful situations, or maybe she just didn't want to talk about them yet. I don't know.
No, and she had a very demanding job there, right?
Yeah.
And you get obsessed with the job.
That's
and
true.
Can't afford to worry about whether you're safe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that allows you to do really good work. If you're too worried, you know, you're going to be...
I mean, that's still bravery. That's pretty much the definition of bravery.
Yeah.
But it doesn't present itself as, ooh, I'm being brave.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right. Yeah, and it seems natural at the time.
Yeah.
I remember some stories like that. So anyway, thank you again to Mei, and good luck.
Yes.
And now let's move on to current war news and current war nerd news. I want to just raise this issue again, John, because there are going to be a couple of events coming up next month in May here in New York City. So if you're in the general region, try and come to this on Tuesday, May 2nd at NYU from 4 to 5:30 p.m. There's going to be a selected readings by the war nerd, John Dolan, of War Nerd Iliad and a Q&A, and it's co-hosted by the Liberal Studies and Classics Departments at NYU. So, and then there's going to be something going on at a restaurant nearby. We'll have more details on this on the Facebook page,
One is going to be co-hosted by you, if we can get you there.
Yeah, you, Brendan. Oh,
no.
Me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm joking. All right. Okay, good. I'm happy to. Yeah, and there's going to be a Q&A afterwards. Right. And then after the reading, and then on Wednesday, May 23rd at the Red Room at the KGB Bar from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. I want to say that when I put out Going Postal, for some reason, I think my publisher, Soft School, I had a book party for me there. I think it was the KGB Bar. I don't know. For some reason, that sticks in my head. But anyway, so you're going to do a reading there as well, right? That's going to be a combo book event and book party celebration. And I think we want to thank Michael Pollack for helping set
this
up.
Yeah, Michael Pollack arranged both of these. Michael is a longtime friend of the show and generally a literary altruist, and that's a rare species.
Mm. So thank you, Michael, for that. So stay tuned for more details on this on the War Nerd Facebook page, and we'll try to send something out to the through the Patreon. You know, I think you can send out messages through that as well. So we'll do it that way as well. And then also another event. And we'll welcome some new subscribers. John, you were on the Chapo Trap House show. Was it 2 days ago? Them's kids is big. I mean,
they're huge.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it's the biggest podcast going.
Mm-hmm.
But they were really friendly. We were just sitting around a Brooklyn living room talking about things, and they were very professional in a way that doesn't make a show of professionalism. They just started talking to me, and we talked, and eventually we were doing the show. So mm-hmm. it moved into that very seamlessly.
Good. I hope that also introduces more people to your book, too, to the War Nerd Iliad book. And I did see on the War Nerd Twitter feed, at least, people saying, oh, wow, I'm buying this book now. I'm buying the War Nerd Iliad book. So
yay.
We want to keep pushing that. I mean, this isn't a book that is tied to a specific current event and, you know, becomes untimely. I mean, if there's ever a timely book, it's the Iliad, right? It's the timeless war novel.
There's always time for the Iliad.
Yes.
I mean, where there's a need for gory comedy, the Iliad will be there.
Oh, right. And you got a nice review in the LA Review of Books. Did you see that?
I did see that. Very generous review. It did say I might be, if anything, too comic in my approach to the Iliad, but I don't know.
Who's going to not buy a book if it's too comic?
Yeah, I'll live with that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you can't do a review without, especially a positive review, without finding something to say. And if the one negative thing is it's too comic, it's like what are your negatives in a job interview? My negatives are I work too hard and I'm too generous. Right. So looking at the world of wars, I mean, I don't know. Maybe first let's just get some of the really grim stuff out of the way. Patrick Cockburn piece. This isn't the first I've heard of this. Actually, when I started digging in, I've seen this story has kind of been bubbling around for a few months since the Turkish/Salafist jihadi invasion of Afrin, which had been under the leftist Kurdish PYD or YPGJ control. Now it's not. And as we know about the Kurdish socialists who got cleansed out of there, but what's less known is that there are also Yazidi communities there. And, you know, the whole Syria war, at least for the U.S., began, I mean, our involvement started, that is the bombing campaign against Islamists, started to protect the Yazidi from Islamic State genocide and rape and enslavement, but to protect the Yazidi. So our NATO allies, the Turks, are using as their local proxies, their boots on the ground, as Michael Weiss would say, basically the decommissioned Islamic State fighters to once again persecute Yazidi. I'm just going to read the top of this article here. Patrick Cockburn, who's been a guest on the show and has done some just consistently great journalism. The headline is, Yazidis who suffered under ISIS face forced conversion to Islam amid fresh persecution in Afrin. Islamist rebels allied to Turkey accused of destroying temples of those following the non-Islamic sect. And Patrick, by the way, a few weeks ago or a month ago, broke the story about the literally thousands of former Islamic State fighters who were then recruited by Turkey to form their Free Syrian Army. So we know who these people are. The Yazidis, I'll just read the lead paragraph here. The Yazidis, who were recently the target of massacre, rape, and sex slavery by ISIS, are now facing forcible conversion to Islam under the threat of death from Turkish-backed forces, which captured the Kurdish enclave of Afrin on March 18th. Islamist rebel fighters who are allied to Turkey and have occupied Yazidi villages in the area have destroyed the temples and places of worship, the Kurdish-speaking non-Islamic sect, according to local people, and then it just, you know, goes on from there. It's a disgusting
story, and I have no doubt about it, especially because this is the kind of vindictive act you get from not only sectarian militias, and these are sectarian militias, but cowardly and inept sectarian militias that would never have gotten anywhere if they hadn't been backed by the Turkish army, and in fact had been driven out of most of Syria before they were brought back as window dressing for a Turkish invasion. And now they get to further humiliate a people they've been humiliating in northern Iraq, and now they're at the other end of the region, almost at the Mediterranean, doing the same thing. I mean, describes an old Yazidi man being threatened with death by one of the jihadis. And when he says, oh, well, that's God's will, and his interrogator responded, shut up, you're infidel. Do you know or believe in God? These are people who are of no combat value, but very good at terrorizing Yazidi civilians and enslaving Yazidi women. And yeah, as Mark said, this is our NATO ally at work. It's a grim story. I have to admit, I haven't been on Facebook as much as I used to be, because, you know, I've been covering Syria pretty carefully and avidly. I can't pretend it didn't get to be personal for me. It did, especially in Rojava. And Afrin was pretty hard to handle, and I knew this would happen, but it doesn't make it any easier to take.
Yeah. It makes you want to look away for a while.
Yeah.
It does. It's totally natural. There's sort of gory war porn that where you have no emotional stake in it and you might want to read about it. And then there's something where you have an emotional stake and you're just like, you know, I don't want to even know anymore.
Because
you can't do anything about it.
I guess the best we can hope for is that giving up Afrin was part of a deal to let Erdogan and the rest of the AKP score some sort of domestic political points. And the most we can hope is that whatever nasty coalition or cabal of the U.S. and assorted forces arranged that deal said, okay, but you can't go any further. You don't get Rojava east of the river. I hope that's the deal anyway.
And then this part of the story is less kind of re-reported, but it seems pretty significant to me. So in Coburn's story here, I mean, he says only a limited amount of information has been coming out about conditions in Afrin since the Turks captured it with their jihadi allies. So according to the UN, there are 137,000 individuals have been displaced. 150,000 remain. So half of them have been displaced, of whom 50,000 are in Afrin city and then 100,000 in the countryside. And people are not being allowed to return to their homes in the countryside. Meanwhile, there have been settlements of some of the jihadis displaced from East Ghouta after the Syrian government took control of it and sent Islamist rebels north. They're supposed to go to Jarabulus, I thought, which is under direct. But they're instead resettling homes of the Kurds,
which is interesting because this is, after all, Syrian territory, and the Syrian government, as it begins to re-cohere and reoccupy its own country, would presumably, and not out of any sentimentality about Syrian Kurds, because they're not sentimental about Syrian Kurds, would probably have some objection to Turkey, an outside power, changing the demographics of Syria. And yet so far, they seem pretty passive about this, which is odd. You wonder if they were part of the deal too.
Yeah, it does kind of suggest it, doesn't it? I mean, if think about it in cold terms, the Syrians might be thinking, well, look, retaking East Ghouta at that point would be more important than anything, would be more important than holding on to Afrin under nominal control, which they didn't
control
anyway.
Afrin is the boondocks. Yeah. I mean, it's not a particularly important part of Syria. Yeah, East Ghouta is part of...
I mean, Damascus is getting bombed every day.
Yeah, it's greater Damascus, really. Yeah. It's important.
So it's kind of a really dark, ugly deal, and it does seem like that. I mean, I'm just read here. Abdul Nasser Shamir, the military commander of Felak al-Rahman, one of the most important armed groups previously fighting the Syrian government in eastern Ghouta. I think they were the ones who were allied with al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, has been settled along with his top commanders in a town in Afrin. Other displaced people from eastern Ghouta are being moved into houses from which their Kurdish inhabitants have fled and are not being allowed to return to, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. It says that refugees from eastern Ghouta object to what is happening, saying they do not want to settle in Afrin, quote, where the Turkish forces provide them with houses owned by people displaced from Afrin. So apparently even some of the locals, probably not the commanders and so on, but it says here, the Eastern Ghouta refugees say they resent being the instrument of, quote, an organized demographic change, unquote, at the behest of Turkey, which would in effect replace Kurds with Arabs in Afrin.
Yeah, so it has a grim 20th century sound to it, but then... Yeah. The Turkish state is one of the grimmest practitioners of 20th century warfare through population transfer.
Yeah, ugly story all around. Another story. I don't know. I'm not sure how much I want to get into. I mean, we did a big segment last episode. I did a big segment on the not specifically on the alleged chemical attack on Ghouta. Actually, after the last episode, I guess Trump bombed Syria, I guess, right after our show.
So, waited for us to do the show.
I guess they knew. They knew that the Syrians would be waiting just before our show for it, so they waited till after. They tricked them. And it turned out to be not as nearly as devastating. In fact, I think the Russians themselves came out and said, well, they didn't, the West didn't cross red lines that we placed. And so they didn't seem, it was a strange thing. I mean, the bombing was done, even in CNN, they admit that they don't have the hard evidence yet, that they're all looking at the same videos online that we're looking at. And so they bombed that hard evidence, and they're kind of implying now that the not fully vigorous bombing by Trump was done because the evidence wasn't totally there, which is a really weird new way of limited humanitarian warfare. It's like, well, if we have some good evidence but not enough evidence, then we'll do some good bombing but not a lot of bombing. Rather than guilty or innocent, it's sort of like, if you're maybe guilty, we'll bomb you 50% of the way.
If we ever get anything worth talking about, we trot out the H-bombs.
Yeah. But Trump came out and said, because it does seem I don't think we should be as smug as most people have been about, you know, just dismissing whatever Trump tweets. Oh, he doesn't think about it. This is already proven, particularly with North Korea, to be a really stupid way, kind of wish fulfillment way of thinking about Trump. And also, because I think every time Obama, quote unquote, couldn't do something, it was his apologists would always say, well, you know, because the power of the presidency is so limited. And then it turns out with Trump, well, no, you can actually do it. You can do peace with North Korea. Like, you can actually do it if you aren't bogged down with your worshiping the Council on Foreign Relations crowd or something. So Trump, anyway, does seem to be serious. You know, we'll find out how serious, but he does seem to be serious about setting up, about basically withdrawing American forces from Syria. And so, you know, this story was broken. I guess Michael Gordon, the guy who he looks kind of like Buster Poindexter a little bit. Michael Gordon, he was a hack in Russia. I remember him for a while. And I think he worked with Judith Miller on some of those fake WMD stories. And now he's at the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, his article, the headline is U.S. Seeks Arab Force and Funding for Syria. Under plan, troops would replace American military contingent after ISIS defeat and help secure countries north. Proposal faces challenges. Yeah. I mean, so first of all, there are already Arab forces there. That's already kind of odd. It's like, we've got all of our Mujahideen forces and, you know, Free Syrian Army forces. So I'm not sure, what does that even mean? Does that mean an actual, like with flags and uniforms? Hi, I'm from, you know, the United Arab Emirates. Hi, I'm from Egypt. Like, is that what this means? Or does it mean a local or mixed local and foreign Arab force funded by, well, again, we're just talking about Nusra and ISIS again, but funded by the Gulf states. Like, but they take over where we are in Rojava, and then you say goodbye to Rojava, but it's not our fault.
In which case, calling it an Arab force is odd, or maybe not odd, but significant. Does that mean Arab as opposed to part Arab, part Kurdish, as at present? I don't know. Either it's something ominous on those lines, or it's just talk.
I mean, I think it's fair to say Trump probably for political reasons, because if anything else, because his own ego said, you know, what are we doing there? We don't need to be there once we take out ISIS. So he probably is looking for ways to get out. And you know, politically, it would be probably more popular. I mean, not popular in Washington and Midtown Manhattan, where all the, you know, media companies are, but it would be, I think, popular, certainly with his base and probably with most Americans getting out. Yes. So then the question is, yeah, how do you do it? And how do you do it and look like you've achieved something? I think there was another article where it was, here's the headline here. From about a week ago, jilted Kurds ignore Western hand-wringing over Syria gas attack. I mean, jilted Kurds, I think, is something we're going to be reading a lot more about, and including with whatever plans Trump has. You know, we were talking about this, John, before the show, like, what, you know, Trump would have a natural affinity with Erdogan.
Yes, they really seem like they'd be best buds. Mm-hmm. But then Obama, who didn't seem like a natural pal of Erdogan, always claimed that they were thick as thieves. Jesus. So who knows?
Yeah. But I just
The idea that Trump, as I think you said, the idea that Trump would think that he might owe the armed forces of Rojava something for serving as cannon fodder for the U.S. The idea that Trump might ever think he owes anybody anything, mm-hmm. it's absurd. So
people owe him, yeah. I think, is pretty much how it works.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's enough on Syria for now. Syria and Afghanistan, two dark and depressing stories. Yeah. And let's kind of move on to some other stories right now. I mean, one place where actually the news is good, although there seem to be really whiny responses from the U.S. The media doesn't seem to like this, but peace is moving forward in Korea. It's still moving step by step. Here's a headline, in the New York Times. North Korea drops troop demand, but U.S. reacts warily. North Korea has dropped its demand that American troops be removed from South Korea as a condition for giving up its nuclear weapons. So basically, Kim Jong-un wants to denuclearize. He said he's done all the testing he needs to do, he may even close down the nuclear testing site, and isn't even asking that the U.S. withdraw all of its troops.
This always infuriates a power like the U.S. It's like, stop that. Stop being reasonable. Your job is to be the demon here.
Yes. Yeah, your job is to be the crazy demon, and we have no choice but to stay there. Now you're making us look like the crazy demon. This ain't right.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to do this. And that's pretty much how the response is. And particularly in the press corps, because, there are a lot of people's jobs in the media and think tanks, weapons industry and so on, that depend on North Korea being an eternal crazy guy threat, and then you need these experts, Western correspondents and some pundits. You need them to explain to us how crazy they are and how we need to do this or that, tough guy thing in order to protect ourselves and keep them boxed in. And all of these experts are being discredited one by one. They're basically being threatened with joblessness, and that's how they're kind of reacting. Like, it's really I have to say it's nuts. I've been following Tim Shorrock, who was a guest on our show, has been talked about North Korea, the peace deal, and we've had him on talking
and
about
who, and who has been vindicated,
yes,
time and again, as this strange process unfold.
Yeah, and if you can handle Twitter, and granted, I don't recommend Twitter to anybody, but if you are on it already and you can handle, I really would recommend following him, because he's calling out every single, like 20 times a day, calling out every idiot who's trying to downplay or falsely spin like whatever's happening in Korea. And remember again what Tim said. I mean, first of all, this is not Trump, although Trump's pro-peace moves should be applauded, and it's great, and it's much better than Obama, but this is local. First and foremost, this is local. This is because it's coming from South Korean activists, peace activists, led by the president, who comes from the left of South Korean politics, President Moon, and coming from North Korea, frankly, and it's upending our, some of our preconceived notions about Kim Jong-un and what's going on there. I mean, unless this is just like the longest, wildest, largest feint in history. And, you also realize this doesn't all depend on Trump. I mean, if the locals are serious about this, all we can do is either completely obstruct it or run to catch up and stay, relevant in the process. I mean, this doesn't 100% depend on Trump if it's being driven so locally. And I think this drives people crazy as well.
Yeah, I mean, suppose, as you say, the two Koreas make a perfectly sane, effective deal and just sort of tell the U.S. forces, that's all right, if you want to stay here, just don't do anything too crazy. Stay where you are, no problem. that would be deeply humiliating mm-hmm. for the U.S., which always sees itself as the guarantor of all security to the peninsula.
And I think, again, there's one really dangerous potential consequence of everyone assuming this is us and therefore just Trump's moves. Because the lesson that they're going to learn is that acting absolutely crazy and bringing the world to the brink of nuclear war is what brings peace. It's that stupid DC contrarian thinking. If you didn't know anything about, you know, how much this is a grassroots South Korean peace leftist, you know, sort of the culmination of that, and how important the role locals played in all this, you would think it's just, well, what did Trump do? Well, he nearly blew up the world. That must have scared the crazy man into acting rationally. And that means we're going to apply that to other places where it's not going to work.
That's a great point. Yeah, I think that's true. And that I can, as soon as you say that, I can see it happening
yes.
because it flatters the national ego.
Yeah. So hopefully that won't be the lesson.
Sure it will.
I know, sure it will. And, you know, one hopes that some people will pay with their jobs, but we know they won't. Mm-hmm. Everybody who's wrong advances. Everybody who's right is declared a Russian troll,
yeah.
I guess, you
yeah.
know, how it works these days. And speaking of that, it's happening again. I mean, we've been following this, John, pretty much since we started this show. These, you know, periodic, as in every couple of months, insane outbursts in this whole sort of anti-Russia disinformation panic, which we lived through the first time in the early 80s. But it's much bigger this time. It's much crazier. And now, I mean, it's reaching a new peak. All these stories coming out. Anybody who's anti-war now is actually a fascist warmonger. In fact, Jamie Kirchick came out with something saying, anybody who calls me a warmonger is actually a fascist, because in the 30s, fascists attacked people who wanted, who opposed the Munich Agreement as warmongers.
He needs a Glenn Beck diagram with that.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there's somebody who's wrong about everything. Hail Mali, or what was this?
Mauritania.
Mauritania, that's right. Hail Mauritania.
God. Yeah, the world's bastion of democracy.
Yeah. We have to just disabuse ourselves of this notion that there's any link at all between being, you know, right, that is correct about something, and being successful, being paid. You're paid for, I mean, in our profession, it's pretty damn clear. Your career value is what you're willing to say for what interests, and not this ideal of being right. Now, thank God for something like Patreon or something where we can have our own show and
yeah.
we're not completely dependent on the same people that Jamie Kirchick is dependent on. But, you know, that's how it is these days.
That's his business model
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah. So this BBC story came out, and they've been going nuts over there against anybody who's in any way skeptical of the alleged chemical gas attack, sarin attack in Douma. Basically, everybody who's saying that is a Kremlin Nazi, you know, fill in your...
Yeah, so this story from 2 days ago is the online activists pushing conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
And conspiracy theory means if you doubt or you just aren't sure about the mainstream narrative about what happened or may not have happened in Douma.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I've said, like... I'm still saying it's possible there was an attack. I don't know that there wasn't and it was faked, but I definitely also don't know that it wasn't faked. We already know that the very first alleged gas attack in December 2012 was faked. We already know that. So there is precedent and it is possible and there's a rational, logical reason for it to have happened that way. And we need evidence from experts or people that we can trust. And the idea that this is the thing again that look, these sources of information, which used to have a lock on what we think and believe is true or not, they've lost control of it, and they can't gain control of it again, and they're shitting their pants, And so what they're doing is demonizing everybody who doesn't go along with what they say. No one, the problem, the first problem, number one, is that no one paid in their careers for lying about the Iraq war.
Right.
And that's problem number one. And so then we were lied to to justify the Libyan war, which has turned into an utter, utter disaster. And of course people are going to be wary now. I mean, you'd have to be, if you're a journalist and you're not skeptical about what you're being told by government or...
by anyone trying to foist another Middle Eastern intervention on you.
Then you're a tool. I mean, you get out, you know, or you're Jamie Kirchick and you're being funded, you know, by them. I mean, if you're not being funded by them and you are not skeptical, you're a tool. I don't know what to say. Like, you're just
there are paragraphs in here that make me doubt it even more. Compared to the shrill assertion that we know exactly what happened, and if you don't think so, you're crazy. Listen to this paragraph. This is by the BBC trying to attack anyone who doubts the story. Quote, the Syrian government and its key ally, Russia, say the incident was staged. But the U.S., U.K., and France, who support the opposition to Mr. Assad, say they are confident that chlorine and possibly a nerve agent were used. Wait a minute.
Yeah, this is, I've seen this in CNN too. Now they're saying chlorine and maybe sarin. And the thing is, if it's chlorine, that's a problem. Now they're going to respin that one. But chlorine, we know that rebels have had and use and have the capability to use chlorine. So that's a problem already.
And that possibly is not very reassuring because it wasn't there a few days ago. It was absolutely certainly beyond any shadow of a doubt. And now you're starting to slip these little qualifiers in, and yet you want us to think that anyone who doubts this story is crazy?
Yep. And then here's another thing that I think is not being talked about, and that is that, on the one hand, we're being told that online harassment is basically a feature of this kind of post-truth, Trump-friendly, fascism-friendly, lie-friendly world, which is harassment. Then on the other hand, you have these state-funded media and these think tankers, like people at the NATO think tank Atlantic Council, people like Ben Nemo and the Bellingcat people, going around and harassing and outing alleged Kremlin trolls as Kremlin trolls who turn out to be real people. It's happening over and over and over. And so they're being harassed. You're being harassed for holding the wrong view. You're being told if you are not, if you are questioning the war in Syria, if you're questioning it, you are a traitor. It means you're either working directly for the Kremlin and you're a fake person, or you've been duped by the Kremlin and fake people. And they're trying to get you to police your own head. I mean, this is how desperate they are to have everybody.
Yeah, it's a real shock to see the BBC devoting paragraphs, as it does in this story, to various small-time pro-Syrian government tweeters and other social media people. It's that the whole campaign must be going very badly for heavy artillery like this to be used on such a tiny target.
Yeah. So here, the government's come out and named alleged, Kremlin accounts here. So this is state harassment here. Government social media experts have documented more than 45,000 posts propagating disinformation narratives. God, man, this is so much worse than the Reagan disinformation panic. And then it says here, one of the accounts named by the government at EN56789, and there's also just a ridiculous second-rate satire built into all of this crap too. Like, anyway, one of the accounts named by the government has told Sky News that he is not in the employment of the Kremlin. He said, I have been campaigning against the neocons and the neocon war since January 2002. So here's a guy that Sky News found, and then there's a picture of him and everything, who was named by his own government as a Kremlin troll, who said, no, I'm actually just act genuinely against neocon wars. And there's a lot more of this. I mean, I keep seeing this over and over. In fact, there's a famous and great Ukrainian-Russian classical pianist. Her name is Valentina Lisitsa, and she has a really good She has a really funny Twitter account. She's pissed off at what happened to her country. She's from Eastern Ukraine. And so one of Bellingcat's partners at this NATO think tank, Atlantic Council, named her as a Kremlin troll. She's actually a very famous and very accomplished world like pianist. I mean, you can go on her YouTube channel, has like, you know, 500,000 subscribers. You can see her just amazing virtuoso performances there. And, you know, this brilliant idiot at the Atlantic Council, Ben Finding Nemo or whatever his name is, named her as a Kremlin bot, and everybody just mocked him for it afterwards. But this is what they're doing. This is a harassment campaign. People are being harassed who are expressing their views online that are not in line with the State Department and with the war party. And they're being harassed and tarred. And this is an old story, you know, goes back a long time, being tarred as agents, witting or unwitting agents of the enemy. There was actually a story, I don't know if you saw this, John, a local NPR affiliate in Atlanta, I think it's WABE, did this story on these black activists, on the Black Lives Matter activists who was going on a Sputnik, which is funded by the Russian government, Sputnik radio show hosted by another black activist. So this local actress went on his show once or twice to spread her message because no one else will talk to her. And so WABE, which is U.S. government funded, called her, said she was helping Russia efforts to spread chaos and dissension in the country. And this is the oldest thing. Like, in, again, in World, I posted a little bit of this on Twitter, but in World War I, there was out of Woodrow Wilson's propaganda committee, they planted stories in the New York Times elsewhere that German agents were running around the South and in cities and stirring up blacks who would otherwise be totally contented and happy with, you know, with everything in America, and stirring them up. And so any blacks who were, you know, expressing any discontent were actually witting or unwitting agents of the Kaiser. It's just...
because, the Kaiser has already been sufficiently demonized that that ought to stick. You see something very similar in the BBC smear. And, yeah, I think it's fair to call this a smear. Mm-hmm. They're trying to attack this quite minor tweeter named Sarah Abdallah. And the attempt is to link her to Trump, white nationalists, and Russia, which is a little odd because she seems to be Middle Eastern. But then in the middle of the paragraph, you get this. Sarah Abdallah's account was primarily followed by supporters of pro-Palestinian causes, Russians and Russian allies, white nationalists, and those from the extreme assault right, conservative American Trump theorists, far-right groups in Europe, and conspiracy theorists. Well, okay, what's wrong with that picture? Those are not very happy bedfellows, pro-Palestinian groups and all these right-wing groups. And then conspiracy theorists just manages to include anybody you don't happen to like.
Yep.
It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And what she dared to say is that, is to ask BBC, why haven't you done an investigation of the White Helmets? And I, since there's no response in the BBC story, I guess that's supposed to be self-evidently absurd.
It is. It's meant to be self-evidently. You're not even allowed to ask. It's not, I know, but you're not allowed to ask
it.
It is just a conspiracy theory, period. And no one, I've seen that used over and over, but no one says, true, they take all this money from the U.S. State Department, and true, it's headed by, and it's got funding from this billionaire who's financing rebels, and true, it's, you know, headed by this whole PR company. However, and true, they've, you know, they've been involved in this beheading and shown here and this, that, and that. However, these, you know, like no one who has said that, like, for example, what Max and others, particularly Max Blumenthal has exposed, no one has tried to say, well, either those facts are wrong, they're not getting this USAID money, or they're not funded by this billionaire or whatever. Or no one has said, okay, yeah, these things are happening, these are true, but it's not fair to draw that conclusion because A, B, and C. Or, you know, they just, it's 100% dismissed. And that's always a bad sign, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so much that the BBC offers here as evidence of the craziness of this really very minor social media person, Sarah Abdullah, doesn't seem particularly insane to me. One of her tweets, which they offer as proof of her craziness, is, "Nobody is happier about Trump's illegal attack on Syria than Al-Qaeda, Saudi Arabia, and Netanyahu." Yeah, that's true.
McCain and Hillary, too. Yeah. They were happy. They were only, McCain was only upset that there wasn't more bombing. That's true. And I can think of all kinds of real people who would share that sentiment. Right? I mean, a lot of people. And again, I think the point is, I mean, we're not as sort of psychologically prone to being affected by this BBC. This is disinformation on BBC's part, where the point of using that tweet and scaring people about how this is a Russian operation is to make you think, wow, if I have those thoughts, or if I know people have those thoughts, or if I see that those thoughts expressed on social media, I need to back away from them, or I might get smeared too. I might, and maybe I'm, you know, and I'm not even sure I know what I think.
This is where all that being ostracized pays off.
Yes,
there was a purpose to it.
Yeah, exactly. But and it's damn sinister stuff. And one only hopes that there's going to be a reckoning for all of this, but I don't know.
One doesn't.
All right, so moving on from there, that story ain't ever going away, so we'll be able to keep going back to this disinformation about disinformation story. Just a couple more I want to go over here. Headline, quote, "We are truly sorry," unquote. ETA apologizes for four decades of deadly violence. Basque separatist group bears, quote, "direct responsibility," unquote, for deaths of at least 800 people in the name of nationhood struggle. That's from The Guardian. So that's 800 people over 42 years, I believe, is what the, over about 42 years.
I mean, talk about death on the installment plan. God.
Yeah, not the one that really impressive one, it seems, is when they killed Franco's prime minister in 1973.
Yeah,
that was for real a bit. I don't know what was happening in Spain.
And I guess
at that
he's supposed to be one of the regrettable casualties now.
Is he? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So. What can you say?
Fascist dude.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then I guess the one that stuck with them though is when a bomb went off in a Barcelona supermarket in 1987, killing 21 people. I'd really like to know I'm going to look that up later. Like, why would ETA blow up a supermarket in 1987? That just doesn't make a lot of sense.
I don't know. I mean, none of it makes a lot of sense. If you thought Basque nationhood was worth killing and dying for, and I have no idea whether it is or was, not my field, but if you thought so, why apologize?
Yeah.
Nations are built on violence, and if your attempt to make a nation cost only 800 lives over 40 years, you've had one of the very luckiest nation-building experiences anybody could have, except that you failed. And I don't know why you failed, and I don't know why you decided after all that fuss that it was no longer worth trying.
I mean, look, one big difference between ETA's, mission and the IRA is that the IRA at least was not operating on the mainland proper, right?
Yeah.
And that battle was, I imagine, to most mainland British people, it was still Ireland, Northern Ireland. They're still different. In fact, we've talked about this. I think that even a lot of English looked at Northern Irish Protestants as not very favorably, right?
Weirdos.
So, yeah, weirdos. So this wasn't like quite the same, I guess, as it would be for Spain. And as we've seen with Catalan, the reactionary side of Spain, they're pretty damn serious about holding that country tightly together.
Yeah.
It's kind of surprising how heavily they've cracked down. And ETA just, I mean, not all of them win. Not all of them succeed. I don't know. What else can you say? To me, it just reads like a defeat statement of, you know, it's, you're not really defeated till you're blubbering and apologizing for everything you did. I don't know.
Yep, which means they are truly defeated.
Yeah. Whereas I have a feeling the Catalan thing, because of the local politics of it, it's just, it ain't going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
I think we'll be talking about it more. Okay.
Have they resorted to deadly force yet?
No, but the central government, you know, they've sent a lot of people after them. And they're jailing a lot of these people. They're jailing the leaders. Yeah. And it's...
Well, that's how it usually happens.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost always the government, the occupying force, whatever you want to call it, that resorts to violence first.
Yeah.
And then you have to decide if it's really worth it.
Yeah. I think that's where they're at. I mean, look, it's very wealthy. Catalonia is, I mean, I think it's the wealthiest province in Spain. And so, you know, how much fighting do they really want to do? I think the central government is kind of counting on that ultimately they're not going to want to start setting off bombs. But anyway, it's worth keeping an eye on it because things could change anytime, and also any sort of, you know, economic downturn or anything could cause that to explode.
An insurgency, to put it bluntly, I mean, there are a lot of ways of conceiving an insurgency. It's are you willing to die and kill over this? Is it that important?
Yeah.
If it isn't, for God's sake, don't do it, because it's a horrible process.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is that precipice that they're at in Catalan, and it's, so far, nobody, certainly on the Catalan side, has crossed that barrier. And I don't think it would be popular in any way if that line was crossed first by Catalonians.
Right.
You know, and I think the central government is just sort of counting on that they can crack skulls, so long as they don't kill anybody. They can crack a lot of skulls, you know, scare some people, and keep it from turning violent. If the government kills people, you know.
Yeah, that's where they could make a mistake, where they go from cracking a few skulls to mowing down crowds. And then you've pretty much triggered the insurgency.
Yeah. Okay, that's it, I think, for the show.
All right.
Brendan, thanks for recording us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you again to our guest, Mei Jiang, and thank you to all of our subscribers, and welcome to our new subscribers, too, and talk to you next week.
Okay, bye.